This is the first of my 143 panels this convention. And I got an easy one here because I get to interview a good friend of mine. I'm Mark Ivanier, I think. Yeah, okay, fine. Yeah, by the way, you're not allowed to say naughty words, says God. I have known Mike since about 1968. I knew him before there was any possibility he would ever connect with Jack Kirby in his life. When I knew him, he was drawing stories for Creepy, Eerie, and Vampirella. He was working with Russ Manning on the Tarzan material, on Magnus Robot Fighter a little. And he had just come off a stint working on the Marvel Superheroes cartoons for Grant Ray Lawrence.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I want to talk about that.
Okay. Can the people in the back hear us all right?
No.
Okay. Could somebody turn up the microphones a little bit? Okay. This is the most important thing a moderator does. How's that? Mike, say something.
How's this?
Better.
Okay, good. I met Mike over the phone. He was living in Whittier at the time. His phone number was 944-5509. I don't know why I remember that, but I do. And we started talking on the phone and then in person. And one day he called me up and he said, I hear Jack Kirby has moved to Southern California. Do you ought to get in touch with him? And I said, no. And I said, why don't you call directory assistance and tell them it's a new listing? And he go, oh, okay, I'll try that. And he called directory assistance and got the name of some woman. Got a name for Jack Kirby, got a phone number and called and got some hysterical woman who was upset because her husband Jack Kirby had just died. And he called me back and said, that wasn't the good idea, Mark. But eventually, Mike got connected with Jack. And you probably know him mostly from that work he did. And we'll talk a lot about that. But I was impressed with the other stuff he did. We're going to talk about some of that. Would you say hello to my friend, Mr. Mike Royer? Some people have heard this story, but we've got to get it on the record again here. Tell us, you grew up in...
Well, I was born and raised in the Willamette Valley in Oregon, in a little town called Lebanon, and I didn't want to work hard for a living, so I thought I'd go into comic books or comic strips. And the closest market, well, the two markets were Los Angeles and New York, and since I was on the West Coast, Los Angeles was a little closer. So I packed up my family and moved to California and knocked on Russ Manning's door, and bless his heart, he gave me work. So by day, for 11 months, I was a credit manager and paint salesman for Sherwin-Williams. And on the nights and weekends, I was assisting Russ Manning. And he introduced me to Mike Ahrens, who became my real mentor. Mike was one of those, the backbones of the artists at Western Publishing, Gold Key Comics. Mike had assisted Fred Harmon on Red Ryder. He said they had to go out and punch the cows before they'd sit down at the drawing board. But he hired me at Grant Ray Lawrence Animation to ink drawings, new drawings that were done to fit between the static artwork that was pasted down and extended. And then I actually started drawing scenes. I did stuff with Tony Stark and the cockpit of his jet plane and things of that nature, and a lot of work on the Submariner stories because there hadn't been enough stories printed in the comic books for them to stat from the original art. But at Grant Ray Lawrence, I was Little Mike and Mike Ahrens was Big Mike, and I was the only guy at the studio who had ever picked up and read a Marvel comic book. And the time that Stan Lee came out to visit us at the studio,
you were still the only person who had picked up and read a Marvel comic book.
And we, all of us, Mel Kiefer, Doug Wiley, myself, and several other artists and Mike are in this room. And Stan said something that I always thought was so insane to say. He said, if Alex Raymond walked into my office, I wouldn't hire him. Anyway.
Stan didn't like hiring dead guys. That's a big no-no.
The studio went on hiatus. I picked up more work from Russ Manning. Gold Key Comics wanted him to produce much more work. He told them the only way that he could do that is if I were assisting him full-time, and of course he couldn't pay me a living. So Gold Key Comics called me up and said, would you like to come in and pick up some work? So a lot of my career was luck being in the right place at the right time. And several months later, I got a phone call from Grant Ray Lawrence Animation. They were back in production on the first Saturday morning Spider-Man animated TV show. I went in and met with their production manager, and to show you how smart this company was, his last job was a manager in the construction industry. So he's now the production manager in an animation studio. And I told him that I was so busy with Gold Key and other accounts that I could only work 20 hours a week. I was a naive 20-something, and he said, well, if you only work 20 hours a week, I can't give you screen credit. Of course, if I'd gone to the union office and told them that, they would have jumped all over him, and I would have gotten credit for laying out one-third of those 20-some episodes. After 3 weeks, I worked directly with Grant Simmons, who was Grant of Grant Ray Lawrence, and he said, Mike, we have a problem. Everybody in the studio is madder than hell at you. And I said, what's the problem? And he says, well, in your 20 hours, you're doing more work than they're doing in 40 hours in-house. And I said, well, what do I do? And he says, bill me for 40. So I did, and everybody was happy.
That's great.
And I almost became the voice of Peter Parker in Spider-Man. Grant Simmons wanted me to be Spider-Man. But Lawrence in New York wanted to stick with Trillium, the non-union house in Canada. So my one shot at being a famous voice actor just went out the window.
Now, I was impressed when I first met you with your slavish devotion to meeting the deadlines. The editor who gave Mike a lot of his work at Gold Key was a man named Chase Craig. And I once asked Chase Craig, I went to work for Chase Craig for a while. He was kind of a mentor to me as well. And I asked him one time, if your life depended on it, who would you count on to turn work in on time of all? And this is a man who worked with hundreds of different freelancers over the years. And he said, well, if it had to be written overnight, I'd call you. I went, thank you. If it had to be drawn overnight, I'd call Dan Spiegel or Mike Royer. And I knew Dan Spiegel already had a reputation for never missing a deadline on anything, and it turned out Mike had that. And this came in handy for you.
Thanks to Chase, I got a mortgage from Bank of America to buy my first house back in the late 60s on the strength of a letter that he wrote saying, we set our clocks by Mike Royer. And we wish if we could change anything, we could get him to do more work. And so they gave me a mortgage, or the loan for the mortgage.
And were you ever late with a payment?
No, never late with a job.
That's right. Now, tell us about the stuff you did for Western, for Gold Key.
Well, some of the assignments I got were, I kind of felt, excuse the expression, an abortionist. Because Russ Manning couldn't do a particular title they wanted, so they'd get someone else who drew totally different than Russ to draw it, and then they'd say, ink this as if it's Russ Manning. And to me, it should have been inked like the artist that drew it. But I worked on artists who I grew up with, seeing their stuff in the books and not knowing their names at the time, and I got to work, you probably know more than I do, but I got to work on guys like High Mankin. High Mankin was the inspiration for Brenda Starr's boyfriend, the guy with the eye patch. That was High Mankin who assisted her at one time. I further got even closer to Mike Ahrens then, and worked with him on a Batman comic strip that none of you have ever seen, but it was printed in shopping newspapers in the southern states, and it was based on the TV series at the time in the 60s. You could probably remember the people. Well, he remembers the telephone directory that we checked with, or the exchange to get Al Williamson's phone number. What was that, 1971?
1970. We were in New York. And we were trying to reach, we were in the lobby of the Statler Hilton Hotel, and we were trying, Mike called directory assistance, and he asked, which phone directories do I look at to try to find where Al Williamson is? And they told him four directories, and he told them to me, and they were Milford, Matamoros, Gingman's Ferry, and Chihola. And I remember that to this day, and every time I see him, I say those.
You know, I talk about how a lot of my career was I happened to be in the right place at the right time or somebody who I'd worked with and they recommended me. But I also met a lot of people that were my icons. And I know this doesn't have anything to do with my career. But I met Al Williamson in 1970 and for 3 years went to a big convention in New York City and stayed at his house a week before the convention and a week afterwards. I got along so well with Al and his family that his mother told me to call her Mom. Not Sally, but Mom. I would call from the West Coast and say, she'd answer and say, hey, Mom, is Al around? And she'd say, yeah, I'll get him, you know. But I have a letter. My friend Scott, who's sitting down here next to Tom, we were looking through my life in a box out in the garage, and I found a letter from Al that he wrote in 1973. And he said, Mike, we really missed you at the convention this year. It just wasn't the same. In fact, it was so boring, I went home early. I had some great friends.
So for Western, for Gold Key, you ate some Mickey Mouse stuff and then Disney stuff?
I did everything from Mickey Mouse to Zorro to, you know, Magnus, Tarzan. I even wrote some stuff. I adapted some Burroughs stories for one of the Disney Adventure Digest stories from Jungle Tales of Tarzan.
And you did some of the superhero comics of the Herculoids and Space Ghosts.
Yeah, I drew stuff like the Three Musketeers, Herculoids, Mighty Mitor. This is up your alley.
Yes.
This guy, if you want to know anything, this guy.
Big trouble now. Birdman. All right, and you were working, and you started working for Warren Publishing for Creepy, Eerie, and Vampirella.
Yeah, some of the work I did for Jim Warren, I'm proud of. Some of it, I look at it and I go, God, I hope nobody ever looks at this. But Jim Warren was an interesting guy to work for. Hell, I'm 76. He was a jerk. Okay? He was a friggin' jerk. The last job that I did for him was one of the best jobs I ever did for him. Still has its problems, but for me, it was one of the best jobs I ever did, and I didn't want to send him the original art. He was paying a whopping amount of $39 to pencil, ink, and letter, and you never got your originals back. In fact, I saw some of my originals from Warren today. A good friend bought them. Anyway, I went to the expense in those days, which was horrendous, to a stat house and had stats made of the original art. And I sent him the stats. A few days later, I get a phone call saying, how dare you unilaterally decide to send me stats instead of the original art? I can't work from this stuff. You send me the art or you don't get a check. Well, in the meantime, I had tweaked the originals. And when the book was printed, he'd printed from the stats. So the next time I saw him in person was at a weekend science fiction convention in Los Angeles, and I walked up to him and I said, Jim, if you were on the other side of the street, bleeding in the gutter, I would only cross the street if I had a box of salt.
So you weren't fond of this man. All right. Now let's, are we caught up to the Kirby era here, just about?
Well, as it says in the program book, it was a dark and stormy night. No, it wasn't. It was just like any other night. And the phone rings, I run into the kitchen, I pick it up and I go, hello, and this, I can't imitate Jack, but it was just great. It's like,
everybody else can.
It's like, Mike Ryer, this is Jack Kirby. Alex Toth says you're a pretty good anchor. And I'm going, I don't think this is a joke. It's not a prank. And I said, yeah, well, what can I do for you? He said he's doing some stuff for Marvel Mania, where Mark was working. And Sherlock Holmes said you'd never assume, but Alex Toth recommended me to Jack, and I'm sure that Jack at Marvel Mania asked you if you'd ever heard of me, and you gave me a nice review.
No.
And he asked me if I'd come out to his house. Well, I'll pretend to believe that.
Okay.
I can believe what I want. I went out to Jack's house. He was in Irvine at the moment, at that particular time. And he showed me the piece he wanted me to ink. It's in the program, souvenir program book. And I said, want me to bring this back to you tomorrow? And working with Russ Manning over the years, I always carried a shoebox with a duplicate set of tools, pens, brushes, ink, and so on, and I had this out in the car, and he says, well, why don't you just sit at my drawing board and do it? And it's like, this is a description of intimidation. Sitting at Jack Kirby's board, inking his pencil, something I always wanted to do. But from the moment I walked in and sat down at his board, it was like family. Every 20 minutes, he'd come in and look over my shoulder. We broke at lunch. Roz made sandwiches. I met their oldest daughter, and then finished the thing. And, well, read the thing in the program booklet, you know.
It's the drawing of Jack sitting at the profile at his drawing table, working with it, all the characters bursting out after. Now, that drawing has been printed hundreds and hundreds of times since then. It's in my book. What do you think of the job you did that first day?
Well, I was scared to death that I'd screw it up, you know.
Okay.
Because I'd always ask the question, why doesn't anybody ink Jack? Everybody was putting their own personalities, doing their own variations and additions and so on. And I look at it now and I think, it makes me think of the ghostwriter artist from the 50s.
Ghostwriter.
Dick Ayers.
Look
at it and I go, oh, this looks like Dick Ayers inked it. Whatever the results of my inking that piece, Jack felt that I could do what he wanted. And so I inked several pieces at Marvel Mania, catalog pieces and a few things that actually went into print, and they also hired me to produce some stuff. A bunch of Spider-Man drawings of Peter and villains, and Jim Steranko came and stayed with me for a week, and while he was there, he did a set of 12 drawings for Marvel Mania, and he says, as a thank you for putting me up, you can ink them and keep the originals. And but then one day Jack called from LAX and said he was going out of town, and he couldn't tell me what it was about, but I was part of his plans. And to make a long story short, he wanted to prove to New York that everything could be done on the West Coast. Because for decades, everyone in New York offices believed that the world ended at the Hudson River. And I think the only artist that ever really deviated from that modus operandi was Alex Toth, who moved to the West Coast. But he never got any work from the New York publishers. He had to work for the West Coast publishers at greatly reduced rates, but he assisted Warren Tufts on Casey Ruggles, which was a terrifically written and drawn Western comic strip. And Warren Tufts, of course, wanted Alex to do the art, but the syndicate said, no, it's your strip, you do the art. I love this segue. Where were we?
All right, let me back up a bit here. The reason that Jack didn't call me at Marvel Mania to see what I thought of the work was I wasn't working for Marvel Mania yet.
Well, that explains it.
No. You worked for Jack before Marvel Mania hired me. I met Jack in July of 1969, and he recommended me to Marvel Mania, and I went to work for them the day after I met him. And you had already done that work a couple months earlier. But the what's interesting about that drawing that Jack did is that Mike inked, that kind of test drawing, if you will, is that Jack didn't touch it afterwards. I'm sure his attitude was, if this kid ruins it, I'll just take my brush and over ink him and fix it up and change it. And he did not do that. It's exactly, there was not a line of Jack's in ink on that page. He didn't feel the need to retouch anything on it. And he also, I think the reason he wanted you to do it there was he wanted to make sure you do it yourself, and not some, you know, buddy in the back room. And he wanted to see how fast you were dedicated, and you did it rapidly. And one of the things that Jack appreciated about Mike, and that all of us came to appreciate about Mike, was how reliable he was. The work, obviously, that he did over Jack is quite wonderful. I think it is some of the best inking Jack ever had in his career. But the value that he had to Jack, that was only part of it, because Jack was fighting this idea that a comic had to be produced in New York or fixed in New York. And the stuff he did for them before Mike started inking the books was regarded, when it came in, as kind of rough material for the production department to put the DC touch on. That was the phrase, we'll put the DC touch on it. We'll retouch a few things, we'll move a few panels around, we'll fix the lettering, there was that kind of attitude that the freelancer's work was always kind of rough material for the office to deliver the finished material. And now we had this situation, once Mike started doing the books, especially because he was qualified to letter them as well as ink them, that Jack was delivering finished, camera-ready art.
Well, I'm positive that everybody at DC and New York they were sure I would fail.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, this young kid that they'd never heard of, you know, I've been in the business, what, 4 or 5 years?
Well, they thought Jack would fail. They thought Jack can't produce a comic on his own out there. He doesn't have a crew of us people like us.
But to their chagrin, it worked.
Yeah, and it worked in part because Mike was so diligent, and also because he happened to... If we had had... Let's say that Mike didn't exist, and let's say Joe Sinnott lived in Southern California, we could have gotten him. Joe Sinnott couldn't have lettered the books. We didn't have a letterer, and we couldn't deliver the finished book. But Mike was... If you had to invent the person that Jack needed at that point, it was someone who was absolutely reliable, could letter the books, and could be faithful to the pencils without changing them egregiously.
Well, and after the first 4 books of the Fourth World titles, Mark and Steve pointed out to Jack how much was being changed or left out. And during that same period, you and Steve Sherman and I went to New York. Was that...
That was the July 4th weekend of 1970.
Okay, 1970. I went into Carmine's office and I said, Carmine, I should be inking Jack because I'm better than Coletta. At lunch, I had lunch with Dick Giordano, and he said, Mike, you got to be careful. You're going to get a reputation as being cocky. What you said was true, but...
But you were essentially telling Carmine he didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah, well, hey, I was young, 20-something... Yeah. Cocky, I guess.
But the resistance was not so much a resistance to Mike's skills, it was a resistance to Mike's geography. They wanted the books to be finished, lettered and inked in New York, where they could keep an eye on it, and change it, and take credit for it.
I sat on the floor in Alex Toth's apartment, on the kitchen floor, with Alex Toth and Carmen Infantino, and I asked Carmen a question. I says, exactly how do those engravers make those 4 plates? I mean, how do they do it? And he says, it's magic, kid.
I don't know. That same weekend, to give an example of the mindset there, I delivered an issue of Hot Wheels for Alex to D.C. He gave me the originals, and I took them in. It was Hot Wheels number 5, which, if you know the book, it's a story that Alex wrote and drew, called The Case of the Curious Classic. It's one of the most beautiful stories that occurred in DC
about a cord
in that period. And I delivered the pages, which were... Alex had written the story, he had penciled and inked the story, but it was unlettered. He had left spaces for the balloons. And he had put black between all the panels. There were black and pen between the gutters between the panels. And I delivered the story, and the people in the D.C. offices, mostly the production department, said, oh, Alex is wonderful, but we have a lot of fixing to do on this. And they were so thrilled because they could fix Alex Toth. And, you know, the premise here is if you fix Alex Toth, then you must be better than Alex Toth. And there was nobody in the building who was better than Alex Toth. And so they tried to make all sorts of changes in it. And Neil Adams came along, and he talked them out of it. It took an outsider who did not work there, Neil Adams, to convince them to preserve the integrity of what Alex did. By having Mike letter and ape the books out in Southern California, we were taking away a lot of their chance to do that. The books came in finished, and now they had to go to a finished product as opposed to a work in progress and put the DC touch on it. And
well, when Jack went back to Marvel after the DC period, and like DC, it took them 4 issues before they would finally acquiesce to his wishes for me to ink and letter his stuff on the West Coast. I was on a panel down here at Comic-Con with Robert, is it pronounced Kaniger?
Kaniger.
And John Buscema and 2 or 3 other people, and I like to call it backstage, in the hallway. I told them that what disturbed me is that Marvel at the time, in my opinion, was run by a bunch of incestuous fanboys who all wanted to ride on Jack Kirby's coattails. So every letter column, particularly in Devil Dinosaur, was pretty much this. Boy, the drawing is great, but the writing sucks. Now, Jack is doing this comic for 12, 13, 14-year-old boys primarily. And when they're reading these books, at the same time in the real world, they're all subject to peer pressure. So here in the letter columns, the comic that they love, they're being told that its writing sucks. And I said, this really disturbs me, and if the sales go down, it's not Jack's fault. Kaniger, Buscema, they all said, you're absolutely right, Mike.
It was not Kaniger, because Kaniger never came to the comic.
Well, it was somebody that wrote war comics, okay?
It was probably Bob Haney.
Probably. Anyway, it's my memory, okay. Anyway, when we got out on the table, and I said that, and of course I got booed, not a one of them said, but he's right. Because they were all still working for those incestuous fanboys.
Hey, if anybody wants to boo, O.J. Simpson just made parole.
You're kidding.
New York Times. O.J. Simpson will soon be freed after 9 years in prison for kidnapping and armed robbery, a parole board ruled.
Well, that doesn't really fit well with me.
Now, Mike lettered and made stuff for Jack for a long time, and he finally, you kind of burned out or something for a while.
Well, my wife came home one day and she said, you're going to be a backpacker. And I said, I am. She said, yes, I've just volunteered to be the adult female chaperone for a Girl Scout cadet troop that has a male leader. So on overnights and longer trips, there has to be an adult female. So you and the kids are going to be part of the package. So we did all kinds of shakedowns and weekend things, and then we did a six-day trip in the High Sierras. I have the color photograph of me sitting on the plaque on the top of Mount Whitney, freezing to death. Anyway, I'm up there at 12,000 feet, looking down at the world, and I'm thinking, damn, I'm working too hard. And the only way I could get this time off was to have D. Bruce Berry and William Stout do some backgrounds for me. Of course, now, if you ask Bill, he worked with Jack Kirby and ghosted the whole issue, but that's a long story. But anyway, to get this vacation, D. Bruce Berry and Bill did backgrounds for me. But I'm standing up there and thinking, I'm working too hard. So I came back down and I told Jack I'd only like to do part of this stuff. And at the time, I didn't understand it, but Jack said, I want you to do all of it or nothing. And I think his answer, he answered that way because he didn't want to have different styles and people comparing, but you probably have some real insight.
No, he answered that way because he didn't have another person to go to, and if he had turned around, the option would have been to go back to New York and say, can you guys find an inker back there? And have a letter back there, and all of a sudden he would have lost that point of controlling his own work and being the editor of his own work. And and also he wasn't going to get anybody out of them who was better than you or as good. It was probably going to go back to Coletta in that case, and they would have said, "See,
maybe you know how long my hiatus lasted. Long enough for me to write and draw a 44-page Jane graphic novel that was never published in Europe, and to do some more things with Russ on his graphic novels.
Yeah.
But I don't remember the exact circumstances, but I was back working for Jack full-time.
Yeah, you were working for him for a while, and then finally you left and Bruce Berry came in. And Jack kind of sees them like a lifeline. I don't think Bruce was ready for the job. I don't think Bruce even thought he was ready for the job. But the job was there, and Jack wanted somebody. He didn't want to turn it back to New York.
Well,
and the other thing, by the way, was there was also a security problem. When Vince Coletta was inking Jack's stuff, Coletta was also looking for Marvel, and the people at Marvel were seeing this stuff. Vince would pick up pages from DC, go over to Marvel, he'd show them there. And Jack did not like the fact that his work was being seen there because he thought they would steal ideas out and get them on the newsstand first, which he thought they'd done on a few occasions, actually.
Way, way back in the early 70s, Sheldorf would come up to Whittier, where I lived with 12 or 14 kids, and they'd spend the day in my studio while I was inking Jack. And somebody asked me once, do you always want to ink and letter Jack? And I said, no, I'd like to do something of me. Of course, Shell was thunderstruck that I would even consider not working with Jack. But at some point there in the late 70s, I just wanted to do something different. And it coincided with Russ Manning getting the Star Wars Daily and Sunday comic strip. And he continued with the Tarzan Sunday strip and doing the Star Wars. And he asked me if I would ink, totally ink and letter, not assist, both strips. And we hammered out a price. And that lasted for about 16 weeks. And on the Tarzan Sundays, the last full continuity, he signed the pages Manning and Royer, which was nice. But as I found out, I would drive out to Majeska Canyon to pick up work from Russ, and Dodie, his wife, would say, well, Russ and Roger are out fishing. So I would go home. And then I would hear from other sources that when he was late with Star Wars to the Black Falcon offices, which were located across from Universal Studios, that the reason he was late was his assistant's fault. So here I am, not doing the work I had agreed to do because it wasn't being handed to me. And I got a call from Sparky Moore, another one of my mentors, who gave me the best advice anyone ever gave me, which doesn't work today, but you get your first job on your ability, every job after that on your dependability. But he called and said they're looking for some freelancers at Disney in their foreign strip and comic book division. So I went in and interviewed, took home a script, inked a couple of things for them, and the head of the department called me one day and he said, how would you like to come in and talk about your future? And I thought, oh, it's going to be a regular gig, you know. And I went in and he said, would you like to come on staff? And in less time than it takes to tell you, I said, sure. So I spent 21 years drawing mice and ducks and fairies and
Pooh Bears.
Tiggers and Pooh Bears and...
Yes.
The last 7 years, I primarily was the Pooh creator for the Disney stores. In fact, they called me the Pooh Man. I designed 3D merchandise. One of the best sellers was... And I'm really proud of it. It was a combination bell jar snow globe that was about so big. And in the snow globe at the top of a staircase, Belle and the Beast are dancing, and there's a chandelier above them. Down the steps are Mrs. Potts and Chip and several other characters. At the bottom of the steps is a bell jar with the rose in it. And all around the staircase is the hat rack playing the violin and a suit of armor and so on. And I like doing that 3D stuff. And I found out that after so many years of thinking I wanted to do Tarzan, Flash Gordon, superheroes, that my bag was Bigfoot, funny animals.
But you found that you could apply some of what you learned working with Jack to that.
Oh, Jack Kirby taught me never to be afraid of a blank piece of paper. Some of the best... huge group scenes I did. It was like Jack in a way, and God, it's egotistical for me to compare myself in any way to Jack, but having this blank piece of paper about 16 by 24, and I just started in the middle. I says, I want the characters making homemade Christmas presents. So I just had plopped poo in the middle and just drew around it. When I was finished, I went, damn, did I draw this? I took it into the art director and he says, you know, we should be selling these things as fine art prints for $5,000 a piece. And I said, can I rewrite my invoice? And he says, no.
That's great. People would know you best for Inking Jack, but what's the work you're proudest of in your career? Start early and go later. What like in the 60s, what were you proudest of doing when you started out?
I was very proud of the work I was doing assisting Russ Manning, because I always believed that you should never know that an assistant had touched it. And I still have the book that I gave my late mother, which I called First Year Apprenticeship. And it's just a hardbound book of all the first year's comic books I worked on with Russ Manning. And I can tell you, I can look at that all these years later, and I could be even 2 years after I had it bound. I can't tell you what I did. But I did a lot of stuff.
Well, Russ told me that he couldn't tell either. I worked with Russ a bit. The only thing you could tell the difference on is the lettering. Because your lettering was not exactly like his.
But he liked mine better.
Yes, he
told me that.
Yeah, he did his lettering.
And I liked his better.
No, yours was better.
No, but I liked him.
Okay. When you were working with Russ, how often did this happen to you? And it happened to me every time. You'd be talking to Russ on the phone, and all of a sudden, a fire alarm would go off, and he'd go, "Gotta go, click," because he was part of the volunteer fire department in his neighborhood.
I would be sitting there with him in his studio, at his house out in Majesca Canyon, outside of the town of Orange.
Yeah.
You know, 16 miles out in the boonies. And all of a sudden, this little box on a cabinet would just start blasting, and he'd jump up and say, "Gotta go," because he was a volunteer fireman in Majesca Canyon. And he'd go out and fight fires and save people's lives, and I'd sit there and finish the work.
The editors of Western Publishing did not think that was true. They thought it was something Russ made up to excuse being late. I mean, how could you fault a guy because his page is late because he was out saving somebody's house?
Well, it's funny. Russ was a perfectionist. In his own way, Jack was a perfectionist. And one of the interesting little weekend conventions that I happened to sit between Russ Manning and Jack Kirby, both men who had, in my opinion, unassuming egos, but they felt that the way they were doing it was the right way to do it. But both of their opinions were different. You know, and I worked for both of them. But what I learned from them was, in my opinion, storytelling. How to design a page, how to tell a story, how to make... Okay, we all know we go from panel one to panel two and down to panel three, but there's the things you do inside that panel that make you go exactly where I want you to go in that panel. That's what I learned from Jack and from Russ, because they were master storytellers, worlds apart in their techniques. And another luncheon I want to talk about. For several years, a group in Orange County called... They started out calling themselves the Orange County Comics Club, and then they became the Orange County Nostalgia Society, which sounded a little more highfalutin. And they put on an annual art show. And out of that art show came several professional artists, like Tim Burgard and... what's-his-face up in Seattle and the guy over there?
You Rick Hoberg?
Yeah, Rick Hoberg. And the third guy does storyboards. Can't remember him now. Anyway... I comment on their postings all the time on Facebook, but anyway, one year, Jack and I and Bern Hogarth were three of the five judges for this art show. And Bern, Jack, Roz, and I went to lunch, and it was a 90-minute lunch where for the whole 90 minutes, Roz and I just looked at each other with knowing smiles and rolled our eyes, because for 90 minutes, Bern Hogarth and Jack Kirby argued. I mean, argued, but they were both saying the same thing. Jack from the, you know, what, New York East Side Street Fighter and Uptown Erudite, $100 word, Bern Hogarth. And Roz and I just enjoyed it because they were saying the same thing, but in a different languages.
Yeah. Very different men. I made fun asking Mike questions. Anybody have a question they want to put to Mike? Yes, sir.
So, with other people, you know, bringing their whole personality to Jack's work, and I've always thought that, you know, Andrews should, if you can hit that line, hit that line. You know, it depends on the foot down. You know,
well, there are several theories about what you're referring to. I just, growing up on Jack Kirby, I saw all of his 40s stuff at the trading post down the highway that you could buy old coverless comics for a nickel, so I got to see all the 40s stuff, and I experienced the mid and late 50s stuff, and then the early Marvel. Everybody has their own ego, and the only ego I had was that it was my job, to the best of my ability, to make it look like it was inked by the guy that drew it if he'd inked it. Now, my two favorite Jack Kirby inkers, my favorite inker is Joe Sinnott, and I think the best inker for Jack was me. That sounds immodest, but somebody asked me once, what is the difference between your inking and Joe Sinnott's? Being a Saturday matinee kid and a lover of old movies, and knowing which movies Jack preferred in his youth, Joe Sinnott inked Jack MGM. I inked Jack Warner Brothers. I can't really define that for you. Maybe Mark can, but...
Those were movie studios.
Oh. Well, I thought I explained it by saying I was a Saturday matinee kid.
One did
Well, one of them was I actually don't think I understand that. Actually.
MGM was glossy and
But
Warner Brothers was raw and to the point. And so Warner Brothers only put on the screen and their programmers what was necessary. And MGM, when they would do the occasional Warner Brothers type movie, would just be so glossy and so good looking.
Yeah, but your work was glossy and good looking too. That's my problem. I mean, to me, Warner Brothers would be like somebody who added a lot of extra shadowing and darkness and cast shadows and things.
Well, that was part of the storytelling. But MGM would put them in a room with tons of wainscoting and columns and stuff like that there.
See, I would say, the way I would make it worth think is like, Joe said I'd inked at MGM, and you inked at Jack Kirby.
Okay, and to me, Jack Kirby was Warner Brothers.
All right, fine. So then you didn't really make a difference, now did you, in that case? No, Mike, the analogy is interesting. I don't know that I quite understand it, but it's good. It sounds good.
Well, I have run across two or three people that know exactly what I'm saying. They go, yeah.
Or they told you they did, they didn't. look, you did this wonderful work on Jax. I mean, it speaks for itself. I don't know how many people have come up to me and thanked me for the small role I played in displacing your predecessor. And I look at those books now and I see the stories are better because of what Mike did. It's not just that the pages look better when you hold them up and look at them without reading. When you actually read the stories, the emotions that Jack put into the faces are all there. The emotions he put into the bodies are all there. This is the thing that I have a problem with some of the inkers, because they kind of strip that away. They made it very shiny and glossy. I'm one of the few people who thinks that Wally Wood and Jack Kirby were not the greatest combination, because I think Wally Wood put frozen Wally Wood faces on everybody. And Jack kept the expression in the characters, and you kept the expression in the characters, and that's what I like about your work. It's you know, everything Jack put in made it to print.
Well, I wrote something on Facebook the other day when you're talking about Jack's faces. The only time I ever changed a face was on a splice page in Mr. Miracle 5, where Big Barda is holding up the cannon, and I made her face. I was going through a period where I was looking at Nestor Redondo and all of these artists.
You were looking at what Dick Giordano was doing on Mike Sikowski in Wonder Woman, because he was prettying up the characters. You said this to me at the time.
And Jack Fomini said, don't change the faces. Now, this is like 1971 or whatever it was. Well, go ahead now to the early 80s, and I lobbied to get Jack Kirby to draw the Sunday Treasury Classics Black Hole comic strip. And I said, and then you've got me, the ink and letter in-house, and to protect the trademarks, because Jack is an impressionist, I will tweak the robot so they're... Someone can't produce those and say, well, that's the way they'll look in the strip, and that's not the way they'll look in the movie, you know, because Jack was an impressionist. On the very first Sunday, the head of our department gave it to one of the other artists in the department. He says, can you fix those faces? And then I hear myself all these years later walking into the office and going, don't change the faces!
Yeah, but of course, the thing is, Jack would have said that to the other inkers, but they didn't work for him. He would have said that to the other guys, he just didn't have the power.
They only got away with it on one Sunday from that point. And of course, the problem with the strip is the guy that wrote the strip was a really nice guy. In fact, he was responsible for Disney doing Bambi. That's another story. But he did these purely literal translations of the movie, and so the strips were not very interesting. As an example, when I did the Rocketeer 3D comic book, the first page is Cliff is flying his plane at one of the shows. Because little did Cliff realize that one week, and then I go to the beginning of the movie. And Jack kind of got bored with it. And so by the last Sunday, he says, Mike, why don't you just lay this page out? So the last Sunday page of The Black Hole, I laid it out for Jack Kirby.
That's a great thing. No, what I meant was when Jack told you don't change the faces, that's something he would have said to Vince Coletta or to some of the other guys who inked him, but he wasn't in a position to do it then because he wasn't the editor of those books.
Yes.
And in the case when he was editor of the New God stuff, he couldn't even talk to Coletta because Coletta was kind of working for New York, not for him. So... When Jack said that to you, that was something he probably would have said to half the dozen of the inkers he had prior to
that. Well, and he wasn't angry. He was just firm.
Yeah.
You know, and I never did after that. He never noticed that I occasionally slimmed Varda's ankles.
Okay, and he had no problem with it. No, he may have noticed that even, but been fine with it.
Yeah.
Because the ankles weren't as much a part of the story as the faces.
Yeah, were. That's true.
So, anyway. Well, anyway, I'm sorry we are out of time here, but first.
Well, according to my watch, we have 10 minutes.
No, we don't. We got it. This is supposed to end at 12:20.
I know. Every hour at Comic-Con is 48 and a half minutes. That's almost as bad as television. Every hour show is 43 minutes.
All right. Anyway, would you thank Mike Royer for all the wonderful work he's doing today?